with a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Should GLP-1 weight loss medication like Wegovy and Zepbound cost thousands of dollars? We don't think so. Try LifeMD.com helps provide insurance access to the leading GLP-1 medications. Visit TryLifeMD.com and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0. Listen to Bridget's story after losing 55 pounds and using her insurance for coverage.
LifeMD helped me get covered with my insurance. Finding out that it was covered was huge. I've lost 55 pounds. I am so much healthier now that I've lost the weight. I would never be able to do it without them.
Get started today and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0 at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
The story you're about to enjoy is a factual tale, read to you from a fictional location. We believe.
Madam, I'm sorry to report that a maid, whilst dusting in your apothecary, has broken two glass bottles of teeth. Would you like her teeth to be pulled as a gentle reminder to be more careful?
Oh, I don't guess we need to go as far as that. It was probably an honest mishap on her part. Besides, her teeth wouldn't make comparable replacements for the spilled ones anyway. She's too young and uninteresting for that. She hasn't thrown them out, has she?
No, but they have spilled out everywhere on the floor and have become mixed together. Animal with human, or perhaps demon. Some are yellow, some are blue.
Not to worry, but they are ancient, so good on her for not throwing them out. If she'd done that, we'd be in need of a whole new maid. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I'm your loyal librarian and host, Miranda Merrick. You've no doubt noticed that we make every effort for your visit to our library to be fun, interesting, informative, and safe. You understand, it's a very large, strangely built old library with meandering halls, not-so-obvious nooks, alcoves, and chambers, and, of course, staff quarters, guest quarters, and our own private rooms. We are determined that your visit be pleasurable and filled with insightful knowledge, not tainted by you becoming lost or injured or misshapen or missing. Your safety is a major priority, so this is why your possible movements about the library are carefully considered and restricted. Admittedly, this is a minor shame, because some of the most interesting collections, other than the rare books, are the personal items that are located in the off-limits rooms of those of us who make the library our home. Mr. Darling, for instance, is an avid and talented calligraphist, and not a forger, as you may have heard. Anyway, in his suite of rooms, he has some of the finest quills and pens, exotic inks and rich parchments and rare vellums, fine paper made from various skins, you know. And I have several collections housed in my little corner of the library. Some have been handed down to me, mainly by my grandmothers and aunts, but several are of my own picking. Some may describe them as mere cabinets of curiosity, but I regard them not only as objects of rarity or distinction, but also amusement and necessity. I love my collections, but I suppose every collector says that. There are some very obscure things in my collections, for sure, as well as many items found in museums all over the world. One in particular that is exceptionally dear to me is the focus of our reading. Tonight's topic for our exploration is one of great conjecture, I'm afraid. It's housed in that velvety gray area of personal belief. And in the telling of its many murky facets, I do believe it will cause each of us to question what we believe and that which our forebears believed. I also imagine that we shall see that those sadly short of resources and knowledge will behave in ways that are confounding to our modern sensibilities, for the most part, anyway. Our topic for closer observation this evening is that of witch bottles, which in and of itself is a strange pairing of words I find when they land together upon the ear. Witch bottles. Let us begin in the United States, specifically the state of Pennsylvania, and then travel back in time from there. Pennsylvania, with the exception of 77 miles of Lake Erie shoreline, is a landlocked state, meaning it has no shore upon a major body of water. It is, however, bound on its eastern side by the Delaware River, and on that river there is an island, once called the Great Tinicum Island, or Little Tinicum Island. This area has the distinction of being the first recorded European settlement in Pennsylvania. It was settled by a group of colonial Swedes in the year 1643. It also has the distinction of being the very first location of a known witch bottle found on U.S. soil. During excavations conducted there in 1976, archaeologist Marshall Becker was able to correctly identify the strange find from the dig as a witch bottle. It became known as the Essington witch bottle and is the first of only 8 to be discovered in the United States so far. Marshall Becker himself described the find thusly.
A curious bottle unearthed during recent excavations in Governor Prince State Park in Essington, Pennsylvania, provides a glimpse of early American witchcraft. Unique evidence of a special white witchcraft hitherto known only from England. This squat piece of glasswork with a bright gold patina over its dark olive color had been buried upside down in a small hole. 2 objects were deposited under the shoulder of the bottle. A piece of a long, thin bone from some medium-sized bird, possibly a partridge, and a redware rim sherd from a small black-glazed bowl. The bottle contained 6 round-headed pins and had been stoppered tightly with a whittled wooden plug.
I thought it may be of interest for the history buffs among you to note here that since the use of white magic was a commonly known practice in colonial America, a well-known minister of the time, Increase Mather, preached vehemently against the employment of it. However, his famous Puritan son, Cotton Mather, spoke out in favor of the use of it, most likely contributing to the popularity of it, as well as the continued accusations of witchcraft against many women, both young and old. But father and son ministers at odds over the use of magic regarding witches. This must be what Christmas is like for some of you. The use of dark magic and witchcraft was believed to be so pervasive in the early colonies that in 1718, actual legislation was enacted against the practice of it. How divine. Generically called the Act for the Advancement of Justice, it held within it the Act against conjuration, witchcraft, and dealing with evil and wicked spirits, so as to cover all bases and not leave anyone out, I assume. It can only be speculated that at the time, if one's own government believed witches to be real and witchcraft to be an actual force, the general public was expected to behave accordingly under the belief of the law. And the government is always correct, is it not? The employment of magic used against magic, the word we want here is apotropaic, meaning to protect against misfortune, to guard against the intended harm from another. I mean, it sounds possible, doesn't it? The forms of apotropaic charms are nearly countless, as the broadness of the definition extends over into the realms of all of the world's religions. This is why, still today, you will see people wearing symbols such as crosses, ankhs, and human eye pendants, and various depictions of saints, in the hopes that these amulets will protect them from harm. They try so hard. White magic, anti-magic, it's all folklore magic, meaning it was utilized by common folk in hopes of preventing evil or bad luck that might be enacted upon them. You may be surprised at how far they were willing to go. With its roots firmly grounded in the Dark Ages of England, apotropaic magic simply grew out of the desperate hope of preventing a witch from causing all manner of evil being visited upon you. Your crop has failed? Witches. You've come down with some horrible disease? Witches. Your cow won't give milk? Witches. Your child was born with an extra nose? Definitely witches. A creepy library has stood on a faraway stretch of land for hundreds of years and no one knows who built it. Excuse me. With very little education, a basic understanding of nature, the human body, or medicine, and no real scientific applications developed enough for the public's use, people tried to reason for themselves what could be the cause of their many afflictions. The most sensible thing to them was to think that someone else must not want them to succeed. Blame was on the warpath. And since most men could be seen laboring away either at work with their own two hands or in charge in some way as landowners, legislators, or soldiers, it was assumed that it must be the women who are the problem. If they know which herbs and flowers to pick to heal someone, they probably know how to do the exact opposite. These women, these witches, this would call for desperate measures. How are you to protect yourself, your home, your farm, your family, against some woman who obviously wants to cause harm to any and all of your worldly goods? Good question. Since insurance policies were not yet available, you must work a little magic of your own. It will require a contribution on your part, intimate contributions possibly, depending on what sort of protection or even revenge you're hoping to exact. That will direct what your magic will command. The practice of creating witch bottles seems to have begun with the writings of an Italian cardinal in the 16th and 17th centuries. Cardinal Robert Bellarmine wrote so convincingly on the subject that many of the first witch bottles are actually little stoneware jugs that not only contain the objects and personal cast-offs as he suggested, but the wee jugs also bear his actual likeness. That's right, his bearded countenance is often featured in the craftwork of the handmade stone bottles. So prominent were these counter-witchcraft bottles that they are known as Bellarmine bottles. They are approximately 8 inches tall, are reddish sandy brown in color, and have a rough feel to their texture, and have a pot-bellied shape. They are often found sealed with some manner of wax or wood or cork, many with their original contents intact. We'll be pleased to show you the photos of the Bellarmine bottles at the information desk, by the way. So, what's in the bottles? In addition to the aforementioned round-headed pins, there are often iron nails, both of which are typically bent. This is to signify pain, the representation of the body being punctured and pierced. The pins, needles, and nails are often found in groups of six. the number 6 being believed to be in direct concordance with witches, and sometimes Satan. The most common element was hair, and quite possibly urine. Many of the bottles found in the UK, European countries, and the US often test positive for the components found in urine. Even a more intimate human bodily fluid, blood, has been found as an additive in witch bottles as well. One would imagine for the precise wish of protection or control over more intimate desires. These spare body parts and fluids, hair, fingernails, saliva, etc., were there to represent the identity of a solitary person and no other, so there was no chance of a mix-up. Other items included in the counter magic were bones, stones, thorns, and pieces of wood and fabric, sometimes cut into shapes like a heart, or pieces of fabric sewn together, perhaps two pieces of lover's clothing. A little traced-down thought about the witch bottles was that they were believed to have the power to reveal the true identity of a witch. One of the most common maladies of the time was urinary problems. Common infections and bladder and kidney stones were rampant and thought to be curses from witches. So, if you were afflicted and made a concoction of 6 bent pins plus your cursed urine and boiled the mixture and secured it inside your witch bottle with a cork-sealed top, and then buried it upside down on your own property, and the witch who cursed you happened by, she would become painfully ill with the disease she set upon you, and then everyone would know she was the true witch. Anyone spot the flaw in this plan? It pays to be very careful, one would advise, when throwing all these curses around. There is one more incredible facet of the faith put in witch bottles that I believe I would be remiss in my duties to you if I did not mention it. The strange and rare belief that a witch could actually be captured and kept inside of one of the wee bottles. Now, this certainly tests the bounds of believability, does it not? However, there is in the Oxford Museum a 4-inch-tall, rather pretty, curvy silver bottle with a waxy-looking brownish-red stoppered top, and it is said that this diminutive bottle contains an actual witch. With it, an antiquated, small, handwritten tag carries a stern warning that if anyone were to release the witch therein, there would be, and I quote, a peck of trouble. Witches being released from bottles and causing trouble. Can you imagine? This concludes our happy little gathering for tonight, my dear guests. Please visit the information desk to see all the luscious things we have for you there. And we thank you so much for coming to hear a reading. No straying beyond the cordoned off areas now. Please allow Mr. Darling to steer you to your exit path. We don't want any curious stragglers to lose their way. Not tonight. Good night.
Enchanting reading tonight, madam. Will you take a bit of tea to relax?
Thank you, Mr. Darling. Perhaps after I've gathered and sorted all those spilled teeth. Care to assist me?
I'd be delighted, madam. Madam, what sort of being had these blue teeth?
Oh, just a regular human. They are most certainly rare and royal, though. They came from the head of the King of Denmark, Harald Blueteeth. Grandma Endora had a wild and torrid love affair with him.
Ah. Not to correct you, madam, but I do believe he was known as Harald Bluetooth.
Well, he certainly was after Granny had her way with him.
I see.
The Midnight Library is co-produced by Tess Feifel and Astonishing Legends Productions and is edited by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell with music and sound design by Ryan McCullough. Special thanks to Miranda Merrick and Mr. Darling. No part of the show may be reproduced in any manner without express written consent. Copyright Astonishing Legends, all rights reserved.